The BioWorld Insider Podcast.
This is the BioWorld Insider Podcast. I'm Lee Landenberger, a writer at BioWorld and your host for today. Each year, a group of trailblazers, disruptors, and forward-thinking executives converge at the BioFuture Conference to evaluate and mold the future of healthcare. This year, the BioFuture Conference is in New York City. It will be held October 4th through the 6th. If you attend, you'll have the chance to hear panels and join workshops and fireside chats with key opinion leaders. It's also a great opportunity to meet with investors and potential partners during networking receptions and one-to-one meetings. If you're interested, there are more details at biofuture.com. You can register on the site. AI will no doubt be a part of the discussion at this year's BioFuture Conference. Artificial intelligence has the potential to radically transform this industry and even reshape how it gets funded. It could help reduce failure rates, risk, perhaps even change the financing model. And it could also go beyond drug development into general healthcare. Our guest today to talk about all this is Scott Penberthy. He is a member of Google Cloud's Chief Technology Officer team. Before coming to Google, Scott worked at IBM at the research department in the chairman's office. He moved on to several web startups, then became managing director in the CEO's office at PwC. He's here to talk about not only the future, but what's happening before our very eyes day to day. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Hey, great to be here, Lee. Thanks for having me among such an august crowd of your fellow podcasters.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to have you here. I've been looking forward to talking to you about this for a couple of weeks now.
Oh, same.
Much of AI is used in the less flashy areas of healthcare, like helping doctors do their day-to-day jobs, but I wanted to talk today about the future, and if we can, maybe a span of 5 to 30 years ahead, looking at the opportunities and challenges that AI presents in drug development. And my first question is about reducing risk for patients and investors. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you, what changes you think will be generated in the next 5 years or so that will change the business of drug development?
The business of drug development. I think... You know, AI is now really becoming a tool of science for the first time. But also right now, it's becoming a very useful tool of drudgery and pajama time. What I mean by that is think of the business of producing a drug. You know, we document very carefully clinical trials. Different regulations require us to document, you know, how the drug's developed, the process, the protocol, and whatnot. And that takes an awful lot of time away from, you know, the actual science of, you know, or manufacturing of these drugs, but it's very important. And now AI can come in today, and we're already seeing it today with, you know, I'm on a board with some oncologists, and they're using it to help summarize patient reports. And they're looking at, well, can I use this for clinical trials too? Like, how do I gather data and report and summarize? And so I think that's where we're going to see it. I mean, we're seeing it today. And I think regulators and others are rushing to the forefront, figuring out how do we make this effective? Because once a doctor's used this, I mean, it's remarkable. They're like, I don't want to go back. I mean, because I can start to produce the documents that I require to do my job well at, you know, 10 times faster. You know, it's kind of like when, I guess when word processor first came out or Word came out and you know, can you imagine writing a, you know, or doing a podcast today or writing anything by typewriter? No. And so I think in the next 5 years, it's very practical, which means the quality and, you know, the language quality, the sophistication, and the ability to write these documents crisply, that's going to get tightened up across the industry and take a lot of that cost and time significantly down. And so that's going to help us in terms of, you know, being ensure we can communicate well. So let's say English is not your prime language. You know, a lot of researchers come from other parts of the world. Now you can write as well as someone, you know, a Harvard-educated scholar. And so that, I think, is going to really help us communicate well among all the collaborators on these drugs and really help in just the day-to-day business of drug development. That's the first place it's going to hit. And we'll see this mainstream easily within the next 5 years, if not the next two. And we can talk later about the more sophisticated science-y part of AI, which is from the simple observation, if I can do this in a computer and I can explore things in silicon, I can then take what the computer suggests and use that to test. And if I do that, could I actually reduce the search space of finding some new compound? And the answer is, well, yeah. I mean, that, you know, we did that with AlphaGo, a few years ago. And now that's becoming a big push. That'll probably lag the administrative part, though. That's going to hit first, because that's just such a pain. And it's just going to make our lives spend more time with patients, more time with science, and less time with the things we need to do to document and be safe.
There's a huge upside in saving time. I wonder, though, when you're talking to doctors and researchers, do you come across a distrust at all?
Say more about distrust.
Well, they're using technology that is new, mm-hmm. and they're not used to it. They're used to doing something the way they've been taught and the way they've been doing it for years. This is brand new, so to get past the fear of the unknown. Do you encounter people that are like that? And what do you say to them?
Before I was working in medicine, I spent some time with folks at NASA and this team called the NASA Frontier Development Lab. And we wanted to bring AI to NASA. And that's 2016. And the answer was no. Like, just no, Scott. Like, what do you mean no? I said, we're a very conservative agency. And it took... Gosh, we did a few dozen projects with them that they sponsored. And over time, they started to warm up to it. And the way they warmed up to it, Lee, is they started to, and this is one of the CTOs of one of their centers said, I get it now. I said, what do you mean? He goes, AI is like an idiot savant. And I said, what? And Dave was like, well, he said, no, Scott, this is how I get it now. And I said, we use closed form solutions. We don't use AI to control our ships or our rockets, but AI can help suggest things. And we can then use that suggestion and test it the way we would test anyone else's idea. And I'm like, well, that's cool. And so now what they're doing is they're using AI in pockets where it suggests an answer that they then take as, just someone across the lunch table says, let's go try this. And they then use that, and they don't answer where it came from. They take that and they use all the systems they've done for years, just like anybody has an idea. And I'm starting to see that now in doctors and patients and insurers and researchers starting to do the same thing, which is a doctor will take a record and summarize it and go, thanks, but let me read it. And they're finding that being the editor and the final arbiter is much more efficient than being the initial creator. And that leverage is what they love. And so it's not like they take the AI and say, just hand that to a patient. There's not that trust. But there is enough trust to take the AI output and use that as an idiot savant suggestion that they then use to reduce their administrative time, their search time, that sort of thing. And I think that's what we're going to see much more is where, AI is not going to replace that task, but someone using AI will replace those who don't deal with it. And that's pretty clear right now.
So I want to ask you about the 90% failure rate that drug developers face. And mm-hmm. I wonder if you see a reduction in that we could attribute to AI coming in the future.
You mean reduction in the failure rate of new compounds being only 10% succeed? Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah.
Well, I think where I'm seeing it is AI is being used by a few firms to suggest compounds, starting with small molecules, because a lot of these AI models, the computation cost goes up to the fourth power of the size of the input. So, small peptides, small molecules are already being used. And, there's some interesting work that came out of MIT and now McMaster's University, where they use these neural networks to basically infer chemical properties of a molecule. And they use that to help identify new antibacterials from existing compounds. Now, I think that what that does is that dramatically reduces the number of molecules you have to try before you go to trial. But I think what you're looking at here is that, that's, I think what we're going to see is the ability to explore the space is going to go up manyfold, a couple orders of magnitude. And now we have the human endeavor that it takes those molecules and that they're now saying, I now found this molecule that's much better according to my tools. Let's now go through the drug trial process. Because, the human body is one of the most complex organisms or machines we've ever encountered and probably ever will. So I guess there's two parts to your question. One is, is the human ability to find a molecule that will actually thrive in the human ecosystem going to improve in the next year with AI? Maybe. I think definitely the ability to find the molecules that we think are going to work, that's going to improve dramatically, right? So 90% is an interesting question because, you know, will the science improve so that we understand the human body better, so that we have a molecule when we go through the trials, that 90% starts coming down? Theoretically, yes. I think what we'll see at first, though, is the speed and efficacy of finding the molecule we think is going to work. That's going to that will rapidly change. And we're already seeing a few companies do this, going from 7 years to, as some claim, 7 weeks, seven months. You know, finding the antibiotic, you know, the paper talks about the candidates were produced in 48 hours. I mean, that's amazing. So you got to be careful with the 90%. Is the ability of our understanding of the human system, is that going to improve dramatically in the next few years, take it 90% down? Maybe. Theoretically, I think yes, because now we're analyzing it from first principles. But the improvement really is going to be in finding the first molecule and getting them into trial. That's really where it's going to see it first.
What about eliminating the need for humans in clinical trials? Is that a possibility?
No. Well, it depends how you answer that. So what we can do now is that we can now create these things called digital twins. They've been around for a while. And digital twins, until recently, were all about probabilistic models based on a number of measures. The sophistication of this is going to go way up because now we can use these AI models, which are basically piecewise nonlinear probabilistic models. Very cool. They can reason with multiple modalities of different kinds of data. Much more sophisticated. So if you're exploring a molecule, what you'll see, or a molecule or some new, you know, chemical compound, what you'll be able to do in the computer is take the molecule and suggest that this might work, and then run some probabilistic models to say, how might humans respond if I've got a set of digital twins? And so what that's going to do is help you reduce your search space. And so I definitely see digital clinical trials as part of the molecule generation process. But then they'll, like NASA, they'll step back and say, interesting idea, AI. Let's now take the molecule for the processes we understand, do it in vitro, and get confidence enough this is actually helpful for humans. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So you still need the humans. I just don't foresee us in the near term for brand new molecules using AI for that. But we are seeing, you know, very early things today with mRNA-based drugs, where we can do personalized cancer vaccines for them, like HER2, like when you're identifying an antigen, because that is basically a copy and paste of like 1,253 nucleotides into a harness that's an mRNA-based drug. And as long as the protocol is the same, you could approve the platform and you could run a simulation on that. They still use animals in the process to verify it. But that makes sense because now you've got a molecule that's well-studied, it's well-understood, and basically what you're changing is a payload. You can do the same thing for monoclonal antibodies and mAbs, right? The tooltip itself may be different, but the basic structure and process is the same. So that's where it may, I think, be more useful. But it's going to be a number of years until we're comfortable because the living organisms were just, and we can just now see their source code. And if you talk to Nobel laureates, we don't really understand it that well. I mean, we're starting to see correlations, and we find interesting correlations. Those are like Nobel Prizes. But it's an exciting time because now we can see your source code. We have now tools to help us understand it. And it's going to be a really interesting few decades ahead.
Will AI be able to better help identify the best participants and how they're managed during trials?
I think ideally what you want for a drug is just the right number of participants, right, to verify it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have the minimal number of complications. And the tools we have today are largely conversations between a doctor, a patient, a medical record, and, you know, a number of metabolites or other techniques. And it's sort of doctor's intuition on matching these, right? Because you can use matching agents and try to find something similar, but it really comes down to a discussion between the patient, the doctor, and the scientist of this is the right candidate. I think what we're going to see now is, since you have more sophisticated modeling of patients, and if they release their data, and you've got essentially what Lee Hood calls the phenome, which is a combination of your genome and epigenome, those models have much more intuitive or much more, you know, precise models of humans to help reduce the search space for finding candidates. So in that sense, maybe you have to talk to fewer candidates to find the right ones, right? That's where I see it going.
How about target identification, meaning finding targets in the biology and the chemistry of drug development? Does AI have a voice in how that may change in the coming years?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's really, think of it like a microscope or an STM or MRI. I mean, it's now a tool increasingly of science. And, you know, in part of that, could you start to identify, I think we may see it first with antigens and structures. You know, are there unique structures that our immune system could recognize for immunotherapies, right? And those sort of areas, that's already happening, right? And so in sense of, you know, immunotherapy targets and finding antigens, I think that is definitely an area. You know, we have things such as AlphaFold and others that can start to imagine and quite accurately, you know, the shape of these things. And so I definitely see it in that region. You know, in other areas of biology, I'm still learning from the experts to see where else it might be helpful. You know, and molecular processes and metabolic processes. And people are now looking at, you know, AI techniques to predict the outcomes of those processes. So, yeah, I think it's going to be used as a great tool for that, to assist scientists.
I want to get your thoughts about cost. Does it cost a lot to use this in drug development, to use AI? And do you see it dropping, the cost dropping in the future?
You know, this is it's a great question. I think a couple of things are going on. One, right now, I heard somewhere, and I think it's right, there's about 100 papers on machine learning every day on archive, you know, where they publish these papers. A lot of them are peer-reviewed. In that, that's insane. I mean, that's a lot of research. I mean, people are chasing this thing, right? And so a number of the people are thinking that, you know, as we start to figure out how to model the human language function, which is what this is all about, the first ones that can really get it right, maybe, I think John Carmack said this, maybe like $1,000 an hour. Now that may be for, you know, in our space, you know, very, very severe conditions where you tried everything else and you need to do a personal vaccine or something, maybe there's a pandemic, something else that requires that level of sophistication. But in the parallel, people, as they're figuring out how to do this language function, people are figuring out new computing substrates. There's a rash of startups looking at how do you get the watts per inference to drop, much like the cost of the human genome, like factors of 10 to the 7th, which causes you to radically rethink things. And when that happens, you know, quantum's another one. If we can get that, and the idea there is that the first truly amazing AIs may be that expensive, but at the same time, the computing cost is coming down. So we expect, you know, and I'm aligned with them in the sense that, you know, within, you look at 2050, a couple bucks an hour, oh yeah, I see it going there. But not until we kind of get it right first, get the math right, get the model right. It's an approximation of our language function. Then we go, oh, this is the rocket equation. I get it, right? And now we have that. Then how do you reduce that over time? I think that's where a lot of innovation will happen. And we're going to start to see new types of computing substrates, you know, not only electronic, but electronic and biological. I've already seen some of that today.
You know, all these technological advances produce probably a lot of challenges that I'm curious. I want to get your take about ethical issues. Mm-hmm. Do you encounter ethical issues that people pose to you or that you come up with on your own in using AI in clinical trials?
Yeah, we've been, you know, at this for years with Google, you know, starting with, you know, search and, you know, Google Photos and whatnot. And, you know, that is a, you know, we take that very seriously. And I think the community at large is also thinking about that because now, you know, you can go touch and play with these tools that we've had in research for, you know, a couple years and the things before that. And so that's really important. And so we think about is, you know, we drafted initially a set of AI principles and we use that initially, you know, for example, someone has a research idea before product, before math, before science was like, I think I can use this. I want to study this area of AI. We use that against the principles to say, is this ethical? Are you preserving the privacy? Are you respecting the individual? You know, where, how's the data being treated? Where is it coming from? And only then does it get approved, can you actually do the research? And then before we publish the research, we're like, hang on. No, I want to get it out. I want to be one of the 100 papers. Not so fast. let's look at the research and say, is it still appropriate to publish this research? Because our attitudes change by time and location as humans. And there are cases where in the past we've seen research and said, you know, we're not going to publish this. It's not the right time. And then they do the same thing for products. So I think that careful consideration, you know, my hope is that more and more adopt that in their use of AI, because it's a very powerful tool. And I think, you know, governments and others starting to lean in saying, well, how do we do this in a methodical way? Much like any new technology, because it can definitely be used for great benefit, but used improperly can have, you know, unintended consequences. And I think that's where we need us all to lean in and figure out how do we do that methodically over time as a community.
Yeah. Last question for you, though. I could go on for hours. This is fascinating. But the last question for you is the changes that you're seeing day to day, just in drug development, do they spill over into the larger healthcare model? And could you kind of expand on what it is you're seeing that is a spillover effect into generalized healthcare?
Yeah, if you look at, I mean, a couple areas that fascinate me, at least in the U.S., you know, there is a lot of documentation and process. You know, the business of healthcare itself has a significant amount of overhead for most of the participants. That's where AI can help right off the bat. For example, learning about your care and benefits from an insurer, you know, going to their website and having a chat. That's an obvious area to go after. You know, are there areas where you can start to understand, you know, your benefits and your partner's benefits and how they come together? Or you need to have an operation, let's say in the U.S., knee operations are very common. And so have you done physical therapy beforehand? You know, have you taken everything else before you actually go under, you know, with surgery? And that requires a justification. AI can help with those as well. On the flip side, those that receive the documents, they have humans reading those. And they're saying, hey, can you help me read these AI and show me the ones that I should just, you know, that you believe are green lighting, but ones I should pay attention to, help me focus my time so I'm more effective and I can help move patients through the system faster. That's happening. Now there's other parts of the world that are really pushing the envelope where there's not as much of a chain of liability like we have in the Western world. For example, in India, they're looking at using these tools as diagnostic aids, where their approach is, these people aren't getting care. You know, I don't have enough doctors to reach them. How can I give them something? And they're starting to look at AI as a tool to actually online, in a search, help you understand what might be a common ailment and, you know, the equivalent of, like, you know, DoorDash you the antibiotic afterwards. You know, that's a lot harder to do in the Western world. But in nation states where the attitude is, we need to give them some kind of coverage. And that I think is going to be kind of leading the world in terms of how to use these in a diagnostic area. But I think in the near term, we'll see it as healthcare is going to get a lot less onerous for most of the participants. And I think over time, when that happens, my hope is that starts to take some of the cost down, you know, as that burden, you know, basically lessens across all the participants in the healthcare system.
Fascinating. Was there anything that we didn't touch on that you want to mention while we're here?
I think you mentioned before when we were talking about ethics and privacy, and that is paramount in all of this, right? I mean, we need to get that right. And we spend a lot of time, you know, if you've been in AI for a while, there's an old adage that, 80% of AI is really thinking hard about the data, the governance of the data, the privacy of the data, how the data is transferred, where it goes. And then the other 20% is complaining about data. and the 1% is the actual AI. And so I think what we're seeing now, though, is that, you know, as doctors, as life scientists, as researchers get into AI, the conversation very quickly turns to how do you do this and preserve privacy? You know, do these systems work within the privacy controls I have within my secure envelope that's already been through my CISO, my chief security officer, right? Those are the pragmatic issues that I find most of the conversations very quickly shift to. You know, the one, there's the fascination. It's infinitely cool, very powerful. But I think now we're thinking very carefully. You said earlier, I'm glad you asked that about that, because I think that's where we can really, as a community, figure this out. And that can only be done with the technology companies in partnership with, you know, the bio companies to figure this out together. Because, you know, as a technology provider, you all know about science and, you know, you'll forget in an hour what I could ever learn about this space. But likewise, we can bring the technology bear and then together we'll figure out how do you do this in an ethic, privacy preserving way so we all benefit. And that to me is the real hard work in a lot of this.
Well, speaking of cool and powerful, this has been a cool and powerful discussion. Thanks a lot for your insight and your time, Scott.
Well, Lee, thank you so much for the opportunity, and I'm really looking forward to the conference coming up here.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. That is our show for today, and as always, BioWorld helps keep you informed of all the most important scientific, clinical, and business updates. We are a daily news service that covers drug development, so if you need to track the development of drugs, turn to bioworld.com. You can also follow us on Twitter or X, and you can email us, newsdesk@bioworld.com. Also, we look forward to meeting you at the BioFuture Conference in Midtown Manhattan that will be held October 4th through the 6th. There are details at biofuture.com. We'll see you there, I hope. Also, if you're enjoying this podcast, don't forget to subscribe. And thanks, everyone, for joining us today.
BioWorld, published by Clarivate, is a subscription-based news service that delivers actionable intelligence on the most innovative therapeutics and medical technologies in development.